At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Hello and welcome. My name is Cliona Foley and this is Off the Bench, a podcast about women's sport, which we hope will entertain and inform sports fans of all ages and genders. You can find all our previous episodes on the podcast link on Off the Ball. Just go into offtheball.com, find the podcast link, scroll it down, you'll see Off the Bench, go in there, and all our previous episodes are there. And also, you can get us on iTunes. We have a Twitter account, it's at Off the Bench OTB, capital OTB. So if you have any suggestions or anything you want to send to us as well, you can get us there. We're talking generally about sport, about Irish sport and sport internationally, and sometimes we see somebody that just catches our eye and really interests us. So today we're talking to a woman that we found very inspiring and fascinating when we came across her story. So we've invited her into the studio, particularly because she's involved in a sport that we don't see very much of, and that's squash. So Orla Doherty, welcome to Off the Bench.
Hi, Cliona. Thanks very much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Orla, tell us something about yourself, first of all.
Well, I'm 48 years old and I grew up in Portmarnock. I currently still live in Portmarnock. I coach squash about 20-25 hours a week, and I also work in the fitness industry. So I'm in the gym there doing some personal training and teaching lots of spin classes.
She was up, so, listeners. She was up at 5:30 this morning because she had her first spin class at 6:30. Is that right?
Dedicated spinners come in. They love it.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But you don't just work in the fitness industry. You also play competitive squash.
I do play competitively. So I'm currently on the Masters Tour within Europe, and I have sort of a mission that I want to try and win the World Championships in Poland in 2020, next year.
And Masters Sport, for people who don't know that, it's age group sport.
Right.
And what age group are you in?
So it starts at age 35. I'm in the over 45s. Now, when you play in European tournaments, you're allowed to play down in age group, but then once you come to the actual World Championships, you must play within
your own
category.
Age group. And they're normally in 5-year categories in all sports, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you'd be over 45 would include 45-year-olds to 49-year-olds.
Yeah, once you turn 45, you're in.
So that's one aspect of it. You're playing Masters squash, but you've also achieved something unusual this year as well.
Well, funnily enough, I decided when I put my mind that I wanted to go for the Worlds, the best way to sort of get competition is to play with the youngsters. And so I started competing in it's called the Senior Irish Tour for squash. So I played in, you know, all the Leinster Open, Munster Open, all the provincials, and then the Irish Open. And as luck would have it, I made the Irish team for my first time ever, actually, at age
48. You'd never played for Ireland before?
No, because when I was playing as a junior, I always was on the Irish team as a kid, but then I took off, and that's another story.
Yeah, we'll go into that in a minute, exactly.
But this is my first time actually playing for the senior team.
Wow.
So I'm absolutely thrilled.
And I'm presuming a lot of your teammates are younger than you.
Well, yes. So there's four of us on the team, and Brianne is going to, we'll talk about her, she's going to be 24 in May, so half my age. And then Sophie is 18 and Laura is 19.
Wow.
So that's it. So I'm the mammy.
But you're also competing on the same level as them.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Which is a 100%. Fantastic thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Look, we're going to talk about your career, where it's taken you, how it's done. Orla Doherty is a very interesting person, listeners. All I can tell you is that because apart from being a squash player, she has appeared at Electric Picnic and she also has a very interesting medical history, which has informed some of your competition as well.
Yes.
So tell me about, were you good as a junior? You know, did you make it as a junior? What happened to you playing squash?
I did. So I started playing when I was 9 out in Portmarnock. And my mother was quite ill when I was a kid and my dad used to babysit us. And so what happened was he would bring us to his squash matches and we'd sit around waiting for him. And I got fed up waiting, so I just got on the court and started hitting the ball. But subsequently, by the age of 12, I was being selected on the Leinster team and then the Irish team.
Right.
And then played all the way through. I went to 2 World Championships, one in Brighton, one in New Zealand.
As a junior?
As a junior in 87 and 89. And then once I left the junior circuit, I moved to England. I wouldn't say I was discovered, but somebody saw my match at the Irish Open against the world number one and invited me to go train in England for 4 years on the pro tour. So that sort of took me away from Ireland then. I was in Reading, south of London, and I competed around the world. I got to be number 69 in the world.
As an adult, 18, 19, 20, in adult competitions. Yeah,
yeah. And I mean, it was tough back then. You really couldn't make a living unless you were sort of top 10 in the world. There was really no money in it, so the travel was expensive. I was very fortunate in the club that I was based. I got to train with Sarah Fitzgerald, who at the time was, she won the World Championships 5 times. So I was surrounded by very elite players. And, you know, as I said, I got to top 70 in the world, but it's not enough.
Was Madeleine Perry behind you?
She's behind me.
Listeners might know Ireland has had the world number 3 in squash.
Yeah. Madeleine, I would say, I hope I don't get this wrong, Madeleine, I think she's probably about 5 years younger than me.
Right.
So she would have come after me. She would have probably been soaring through junior squash when I was sort of, you know, coming into my peak.
Relatively speaking, again, with sports that aren't that well known, she's relatively unknown in Ireland, but the level that she reached and her success.
It was unbelievable. Top 3 in the world.
Yeah,
incredible.
She has retired now.
Yeah.
But people, you know, if they want to find out more about her, go and have a look and see just how great she was.
Well, I'm kind of hoping she doesn't make a comeback for the world because she might be in my age group.
I was just going to say she could go back into your age group, exactly.
Yeah.
So, so you were in England, and then your life took you to America at some point.
So I initially came back from England for about a year. I basically got fed up and burnt out. The squash wasn't working out from a professional level. And I was home for about a year. And, well, I mentioned the gay thing. I was working in Break for the Border the very first year that it opened up, just around the corner.
Yeah,
I lied in the interview and I said I was a bartender, which I wasn't.
We've all done it, Orla.
So I got that job. But the same year, I was about 22, I'd say, I came out. I was gay. I still am. And my parents were not too pleased, as you can imagine, back then. And I think up until 93, it was still legal. It was very frowned upon. And
there would have been a
It was a worry. My parents were both very worried about me. And a couple of my friends had applied for the green card to go off to the States. And my dad said, why don't you just apply? You know, you're going to have a miserable life here. See where it takes you. And in actual fact, I was the only one out of my 4 friends who won it that same August.
Got a green card.
Yeah. And landed in San Francisco with about £500 in my pocket. And
what year is this?
This was 93.
Right.
So I was 22, very naive, and everybody was sure I'd come back, you know, within...
You'd be back within a year or two, yeah.
So the first job I ever got, it was in Mrs. Field's cookie factory. I was wearing one of those hats, you know, on the...
when Ireland didn't call biscuits cookies.
No, this is it. But, you know, luckily enough, my squash really took me to so many places. I ended up staying, I met a woman, I'll say, who, you know, love brings you places, and I ended up going to Las Vegas of all places, and there was a squash club there where I walked in and I hadn't played for about a year, and picked up a racket, and there was a woman standing behind the court. Her name is Amy Malanick, and I call her my squash angel. She lives in America now. She said, who the hell are you? And how are you able to hit the...
This girl's got
game. I kind of brushed it off, didn't want to know. I was kind of had my thing with squash. But anyway, she found me. She saw my name in the visitor's guest book, and she tracked me down. And she came, and she literally knocked on my door, and she said, you've got to start playing again.
Wow.
So, and she was my bridesmaid, and we ended up being fantastic friends. So I got back into the squash and ended up working for her as a part-time coach in Vegas. Met another woman, as you do, and got a job in Brooklyn in the Heights Casino, which is probably one of the most established squash clubs in America, for a woman named Alicia McConnell, who subsequently is now living in Ireland. Another story. It's a great story. I'll tell you in a second. and became a full-time squash coach. So basically, I had sort of that two-year break where I didn't, you know, traveled, went to America, did what I was going to do. And here I am suddenly coaching in the United States.
And was it big in America, and could you make a living?
It was absolutely, yes. So at the time, as an assistant coach, you get a salary just to be there. And at the time, I was probably making about $1,000 just to be there. And then the amount of coaching that you can do depends upon yourself. But I was making a handy living, you know, up to $3,000 a month at the time anyway.
Right.
And this is 94, 95.
Just coaching. And squash was obviously bigger in America.
Yeah, and I was really lucky to get into this particular club, the Heights Casino. Anybody who knows squash in America will be very familiar. It's by far one of the best clubs in the country.
Did you say it was in...
It's in Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, right.
Yeah,
so you were based in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Had a great time there. From there, I got a phone call out of the blue from a chap named Richard Millman, who's also an absolute legend of American squash, if anyone in America is watching this. Richard Millman was working at Cornell University at the time and was deciding that he was going to make a change in his career path. And he said, we're looking for a female head coach for Cornell University, which is one of the Ivy League schools, what an opportunity. So I was probably 26, 27.
Wow.
Went for the interview, got the job, and coached at Cornell University for probably 3 years. And so a lot of the students were close to my age. So I was 27, they're 22, 23. But I had a fantastic time and brought the team from sort of bottom 20 in the country up to top 8 in the country.
Wow.
Now, I was lucky to have a Spanish player show up on my lap, and she was amazing.
We all need looking like.
Yeah. And from there, I hope I'm not rambling, but
no.
I wanted to be close to my partner, who at the time was living in Boston.
Right.
And it was a tough commute. Cornell is kind of in Ithaca, which is very, very far north in New York, upstate New York. I was always interested in sort of urban programs, and there was a new, brand new urban program opening up called Squash Busters, which was the very first of its kind. And what it did was it catered to underprivileged children, invited them to play squash, do their homework, get out in the community, help in the community. And it was a fantastic initiative by a man called Greg Zaff, who is also, I'm pretty sure he's in the Hall of Fame at this point. I rang him up and I said, this is something that really interests me, is working with underprivileged youth. And he was looking for a squash coach.
Coach, as you do.
So went for the interview, got that. We were literally based in a tiny trailer. His office was in his house, and he rented a 12-seater van. And we used to go around and pick up the kids. And we were given the use of courts at the Harvard Club in Boston, which is a very prestigious elite club that you would go in and you can only wear your white clothing, and you know,
a bit like Fitzwilliam here.
Well, it's very similar.
Yeah.
And you know, bringing in these underprivileged, and you know, every race we're talking, still even back in the 90s, it was
multiple
a little bit kind of at the time, what, you know, why are these kids here kind of thing. We were allowed to use the courts there. We also were allowed to use, there was courts at the YMCA, old racquetball courts.
Yeah, because in urban America, you see handball courts because the Hispanics play handball as well. So you do see walls and courts outdoors, even downtown New York.
Absolutely.
So you could use those as well for urban kids program.
Exactly. We would use whatever we could. And then we were allowed, there was a little chapel in the YMCA that we went to do our study. So they would do their homework. We'd have volunteer tutors come in and help the kids with their homework. And that was probably, I'd say, one of the most fulfilling jobs I've ever
fabulous.
Had.
Yeah.
So I was there with them for nearly 10 years. At the same time, I was there for the last 3 years, you're going to laugh, I got a little part-time job with JetBlue, just to try my hand at something different. And I'm going to tell you a story about that in a minute, how I crashed the jet bridge into the plane, but that's neither here nor there. I also worked part-time.
When you say JetBlue, you're assuming airlines.
Yes.
Were you working, were you working
just
stewarding?
For a supplement. No, I was... I suppose the person at the desk who would check
in. Oh, right, yeah, exactly, yeah.
They wouldn't let me on the plane.
They were grand staff.
Grand staff. But that was because I was about to get married and we needed a little bit more income. And then I also had a part-time job at MIT, which is Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is a fantastic school, coaching the men's team. And these guys are the most intelligent people. Like, it was difficult to coach them because they were all about the angles.
Intellectual
and the,
thinkers.
Absolutely,
yeah, 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 yeah. Scientists and thinkers.
Fantastic experience. And then from there, so that was 10 years in Boston. I had a very good friend, Demmer Holleran, who was the US champion over, I'd say 10 times over, in both singles and doubles. And she was about to open her own club in Philadelphia with 12 squash courts and 2 doubles courts, and she was looking for somebody to help her sort of open it up and run it, and we'd been friends for a long time, so it was a great opportunity to sort of step a little bit away from the coaching and into more management of a club.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I'd been coaching at this point probably 13 years, so I went with Demmer to open this club, had a fantastic time, was there probably 2 years, my father passed away, and I had a really difficult time with it.
Right.
So all hell broke loose, got divorced, got diagnosed with bipolar disorder, was admitted many times. I have some incredible stories about being inside, on the inside. it was a really hard time.
And was there, can I ask you, was there, do you think that there was, had you struggled with your mental health? Was there an underlying condition? Or was it all brought on by that incident?
No,
or
were
you ever worried about your mental health before that?
Yeah, but you know, back then it wasn't really considered, you know, people didn't know what it was. I would say I was always very, very, very either, you know, I'd be the person who'd stand on the table and dance.
Yeah.
And then I'd go into dark places but would never go outside, and suffered a fair bit from paranoia where I didn't want to be around people. And I, you know, I can remember as a child even feeling depression at the age of 12, 13.
Wow.
But, you know, nowadays.
Well, we didn't put a name on things back then. We weren't as vocal about that.
And when I told my family, I rang them and I said, listen, I've been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. The first thing my brother said was, is that some sort of bear thing from the North Pole? Or, you know, nobody really could understand. And then my cousin thought I had cancer and I was terminal and was going to die. You know, even the term bipolar, which, as you know, is the same as manic depression. And a lot of people didn't understand that manic depression is mania and depression.
It suffers. It's a huge arc. It's a big arc of spectrum.
Yeah. So.
And so how was that treated, and how
so
how did
so
you
in America
it?
They were very on top of it. But you know, the very first thing they want to do is medicate you.
Which is medicine, yeah.
And of course, I didn't know if I should say yes or no, and my family didn't know what to do. So they're like, of course, you have to go on the medication, because I did try a suicide attempt. So anyway, I was put on some pretty serious stuff. Lithium was one of the ones I was on, and I'd say over the course of the next 10 years I was pretty severely medicated. You managed to find a way to deal with it, but I think the biggest thing I struggled with was the numbness. So I have
the
this
not feeling.
I'm told I have a night sort of bubbly personality. You probably disagree.
Having met you briefly,
people were noticing that I'd be very, you know, if I went to a party or whatever, or even out socially playing squash, I was sort of low key, kept to myself. And I definitely dabbled with, I'd stop taking the meds for maybe a month, and then you kind of go, woo, and then suddenly you crash down again. So it was a case of, can I cut back on the medication, or, you know, what do I do? How do I manage it? I had a very, very good friend. Her name was Debbie Brown, who I'd met in Minneapolis at a squash tournament. And around the time that my father died, she rang me up, and she was living in Santa Barbara. And she said, you need some sunshine. Get your butt out here. And she had frequent flyer miles, whatever. So anyway, here's where it gets interesting. We'd been friends for a long time. When my father died, I got divorced. I flew out to California to get some sunshine because I'd quit my job because I'd been diagnosed with bipolar disorder because I was hospitalized. It turns out, I had a great time. And Debbie and I fell in love. And there was a job going as a head squash pro.
In Santa Barbara.
In Santa Barbara. And, you know, at the time we thought this town isn't big enough for both of us because it's a pretty small town.
Yeah.
And she's also a very vivacious person. But we made it work, and I subsequently moved out there and was there 10 years. And we got married about 5 years later.
Wow.
And we had a great time there. I was the head coach, making a really nice salary there. And then at the same time, Debbie was involved with this urban program that I had done something similar in Boston. So I partnered with her and we ran this program called the Santa Barbara School of Squash. And it was for mostly Latino students, a lot of Mexicans who had come up illegally, and beautiful people, really, really. We had such a great time with them. We still keep in touch with these kids. They write letters to us all the time. Taught them squash, did their, you know, homework with them, went out into the community, cleaned the beaches, fed soup to the homeless, you know, fantastic. And so I was doing that with Debbie part-time, and then I was also coaching quite a fair bit.
And how was your health at this point?
So I was still on medication. I think the weather did me good.
Yes.
I was definitely happier.
Sunshine does
really help. But I kind of knew at the back of my mind that I wanted to be off the meds at some point in my life. I wanted to try and manage it myself. And about 4 years ago, I'd say, I found a really nice psychiatrist who was sort of managing. I actually was admitted twice in Santa Barbara as well for mania. So it was a question of how do you manage the mania. But this particular doctor, I went into him and I said, look, I really want to try coming off the medication. And it was really important to him that I took at least 6 months to do so. Mm. You can't sort of just go cold turkey.
Yeah.
And he was great, and he sort of helped me do this, and you, obviously you need counselling and the whole nine yards. But when you have a good support system around you, I have great friends. Debbie's fantastic. And I've since been off for the last 4 years, and knock on wood, you know, you definitely have your moments. But I think since I've started really involving myself in squash again, it's, and I suppose this is why I'm here.
And I was curious as to whether, as to how important do you feel your immersion back in squash and at elite level squash, how that has benefited from you, for you mentally as physically.
It's been absolutely huge for me. You know, I was ill, just to get back to one quick thing, about 2 years ago I had a little mini stroke, a little TIA, where I lost the power on the side of my this left side, and then I've had a little loop recorder inserted. And then about a year later, which would be a year ago from now, I kind of was just like, what is going on? I just want to get back into squash again, be fit again. I was sort of encouraged by a friend of mine, Kathy McGivney, at the Portmarnock Sports and Leisure Centre. Why don't you get certified to be a personal trainer? It sort of goes hand in hand with your coaching.
Yeah.
And as I was taking this course, I was getting fitter and stronger. I also met Clean O'Connor, who you know.
Yeah, just former Dublin ladies' football
all-star.
Goalkeeper.
Completely randomly, she was looking for squash lessons and had reached out to me, and I did take forever to get back to her. But so whenever we ended up coaching, I was coaching her for squash for about 3 or 4 months, and she also was encouraging me, why don't you play again? Why don't you get competitive? And I had this sort of desire to compete, because I had been playing quite well, and I was keeping my hand in it. I was playing league in Sutton, and I was just, I think at my age, I was starting to enjoy playing more, whereas before it was almost like I was playing for other people, not for myself.
Yeah.
And so Clean and I came to this arrangement where I would give her free squash lessons, she would get me in the gym and kick my butt into shape, and of course doing this personal training course. So it was all coming hand in hand. Everything sort of happened together, and I set my mind on winning the World Championships, and I went and played in the Welsh Masters last December. I'd become fairly fit compared to what I was, and got to the final unseeded and lost to a lady from, I don't want to get it wrong, Slovakia. Henrietta was her name, and was absolutely thrilled. So that was step one. Okay, I can do this. I can compete with the Masters in Europe, and you get a taste for it.
Yeah, and the competitive edge kicks back in.
But you know, to answer your question about the mental health side of things, being fit and strong and then suddenly performing at a high level in a sport that I've always loved but never superly enjoyed, and now it's all happening together, and I feel absolutely fantastic at the moment. I've found this joy, and that sounds very deep.
No, it's not.
But it's sort of
people find their joy in sport all the time.
It's amazing, and people look at me and say, how are you doing it all? You're 48. And, you know, I'm training in the gym, you know, thanks to Kleena. She's got me really doing the right things, and she's very, very good at what she does.
Kleena works as a performance coach as well.
She has been doing that for me my last three tournaments, the Irish Masters, Slovenia and Spain. And Kleena will pick up the phone, and she'll spend an hour saying, and she'll break down, what are your tactical goals? What's your mindset? What are your technical goals? And she finds a way to ask all the right questions that get me thinking, because I tend to go, I overload. I overthink. She has me doing little stupid things like 2 hours before the match, don't even think about it, do a puzzle, you know.
Yeah, take your mind away from it.
Take your mind completely. So she has all these tools that she's equipped me with.
And the results have been good.
And, well, I won Spain, I won Slovenia, I won Ireland.
So you won the Slovenian Masters and you won the Spanish Masters since the start of the season.
Yeah, and the Irish Masters.
And the Irish Masters as well. You got selected on the Irish senior team.
Yeah,
and
so it's been quite
a
whirlwind of a year. We're going to the European Championships in 2 weeks
in Birmingham.
And so there's 23 countries from Europe are competing, and there's going to be, you know, probably 7 of the top 10 countries in the world will be there.
And is it because squash, you know, and we'll talk about the renaissance of it, because it's not a big competitive sport here, do you have to self-finance? How do you manage for...
Yeah,
for
I'm self-financing at the moment. Now, the nice thing about the Europeans, because it's a senior event, Irish squash are paying
for
that.
Ireland, yeah.
But any of the European, that also is all, you know, coming out of my pocket. It's tough, but, you know, it's
It's what you love.
It's what I love, and it's making me happy at the moment.
People might be looking and wondering about your choice of clothing.
Yes.
One of the things that caught my eye about you. We'll talk about Clina in a minute. One of the things that caught my eye with you, actually, on your social media was that you wear really bright colours when you're playing. First of all, where do you get your gear? And because people are going to know. And secondly, why is it important to you to wear bright clothing?
Yeah, I think, so I'm very lucky. I have a friend, his name is Alan Byrne, and he started out, he sponsors me for my equipment, which is a company called Salming, and he was giving me my rackets and shoes and bags. And when I started getting successful, I kind of said, hey, wouldn't it be nice if I had some clothing?
Yes, of course.
You get a little bit cocky. And he smiled, and he has a company in Ireland called Stuff Marketing, and he imports a brand called Lucky in Love. Now, that's the name of a
sports clothing brand?
They're a tennis and golf clothing
specialist
based in Miami.
Ah.
And their sort of leader of their sort of logo look brand is Bethany Maddox Sands, who's a very well-known tennis player in America.
Right.
So she, I think, designs these clothes. And so he's brought it over to Ireland, and it sells in Fitzwilliam and it sells in Sutton. And it's, I've been wearing it, and I love it because it's so bright.
It is bright. It's really eye-catching.
You know, people laugh at this jacket. This is Lucky in Love, and this is also one of their shirts. But it's just bright, and I feel good when I'm out there. And you know, people are now coming to me in tournaments and saying, "What's it going to be today? What are you going to wear later?" And they just love, and it's good for the camera. You know,
it's attractive. So it makes you feel good to wear something bright, as you say, it's eye catching.
Yeah.
And it probably can lead to other stuff because people will notice you. Because I noticed it on social media. It's one of the things I noticed. I went, "Wow, look at her pink socks!" And you know, that's great. Because so many sports need a visual element, and squash for years was very white and you know, male and
exactly.
very staid, if you like.
Yeah.
That's certainly an interesting element of it. I've noticed just from looking in the last few years, watching again stuff around the world, I've seen squash being played in glass courts, and I've seen it being in I think Grand Central Station. I saw one, and I saw one in Dubai in a supermarket. Is squash getting really modern now?
What's with
the glass cases?
Well,
the glass courts.
Any professional event now that you would look at it's on Eurosport, PSA Squash have their own TV. There will always be a glass court, and so the four walls are glass. And the way they have it designed is the back wall you can see out. Once you're in the court, you can see out because you need to see the referee, etc. But the other side walls and back wall would be sort of tinted.
So
you and I could watch and see in perfectly well. So you can sit on the side and sit on the front wall. But
when you're in it, can you see out?
It's not a distraction
at
all.
Right.
And a lot of it has to do with, you know, we're dying to get into the Olympics. It should be an Olympic sport. I mean, Forbes magazine rated it as the most healthiest sport in the world.
Very high endurance levels, brilliant cardio.
It's unbelievable.
Race,
you'll burn 800 calories in an hour of squash, no bother. And it's accessible. But the thing with the ball is it's not as visual as... This is one of the things they come back and say, is it's not like for TV, for the Olympics. It's very difficult
to see it.
They're working, they're designing the material and the ball now. It's a white ball, and the floor would generally be, you know, blue or darker color so you can see it, and then the walls would be a darker color. So it's really, if you watch any, you know, YouTube professional squash, and they have them in the pyramids in Egypt.
Yeah, I've seen
you
that.
You said yourself, Grand, you know, in supermarket, huge shopping centers. There's one in the Symphony Hall in Boston. You know, and when I go to Birmingham,
used competitively.
Well,
or
you break it down.
They
would do it for a special.
Yeah,
a special
bring it
event.
In. You can take them apart.
And they're very easily stored.
And is there any in Ireland?
Well, interestingly enough, Gar Houlihan, who's the president of Irish Squash, he's being very proactive at the moment in trying to get one over here, because what's happening is we have so many good top level junior players. And in fact, one of which I have to give a shout out to Sam Buckley, who's. He reached the semi-finals of the European Junior Boys Under 19 Championships today. He's playing.
Wow. Right.
He's in Prague. So good luck, Sam. The kids who are playing at this level need to practice on the glass court because it's such a different feel when you're hitting the ball.
Completely different.
And they would
and
have
they're
to
competing
travel.
On them when they go
yeah,
abroad.
So they literally would go to Bristol or Manchester or something to get the practice time.
Right.
Whereas now Gar Houlihan is really being very active about trying to get one that we can keep in Ireland
and
we can sort of erect wherever there's a tournament.
Yeah.
Next Tuesday is the beginning of the Irish Open Championships in Fitzwilliam. So it's, I think, I want to say it's a satellite. I don't know what level of pro tournament it is, but there's going to be professionals coming from America, Germany, Egypt, if anybody's interested in going to Fitzwilliam next week.
Okay.
From Tuesday the 23rd, all week. It's the Irish Open Championships.
So the week of April the 23rd onwards, just after Easter then.
So, for example, in the future when we have this event, to have a glass court erected out maybe in the parking lot or car park, I should say.
Yeah.
Would be
it's amazing because visually it's very eye-catching, and I know with athletics they've done stuff like that as well, bring events, you know, jumping or events into the middle of shopping centres just to publicise the sport, let people have a look at it and stimulate interest.
You're walking through
interest.
Grand Central Station, you're just going to get your train and suddenly you see this incredible sport.
That's the one that caught my eye because I saw a video of it, it looked incredible.
When we're in Birmingham, sorry to keep interrupting, in May they're putting one up for the world, for the Europeans, so I'm excited to get a hit on that.
So you're doing all of that. So you're now your coach. You're a fitness coach as well. You're playing competitive at the highest level that you've ever played.
Yeah.
And somehow, in the middle of all of this, Orla de Hardy, you managed to perform at an electric picnic. Can you explain to our listeners how you came to perform at electric picnic?
Oh my goodness.
Please?
Okay.
Were you playing squash?
No, I was not playing squash. You're going to make me say it. I used to dabble in a little bit of stand-up comedy. And it wasn't initially something I ever sort of went after. But when I moved home from America, I was friendly with a group of ladies who played tennis in Portmarnock. And we'd go up and I never used to drink gin. And they introduced me to gin and tonics.
The ruin of many.
Yeah. And we would sit out there on the balcony in the bistro and have our gins, and they suddenly had this notion in their head that, oh, Orla's very funny. And, you know, the way I look at it is everybody who's Irish is funny. When you go to America, an Irish person is hilarious. And whether it was, I don't know, my delivery, I don't know what, but one of them, Jennifer Hurst, I'll never forgive you for this, she put my name forward to a Love in Dublin post that came up on Facebook. Have you got any mates who you think are funny? We're looking for a new talent, we'll say. So she put my name in, and I suddenly got this phone call from the guy who runs Cherry Comedy at Whelan's. And he said, come on, they wouldn't put you forward if they didn't think you were funny. And there was no way I would ever show any interest in, you know,
stand-up comedy.
Anyway, between one thing and another, he convinced me to do it. And I don't tell jokes at all. I basically did 8 minutes where I talked about my life, some of the stuff that you've heard about. I elaborated on, you know, wanting to be a nun when I was a kid and being married twice. I didn't mention that my current wife was bridesmaid in my first wedding. And, you know, there's lots of stuff thrown in there. Anyway, the comedy went well for that 8 minutes. And lo and behold, I was getting calls to do some more stuff around the country. I went to Limerick, went to Cork, went to Wexford. And then Emily O'Callaghan was at the Funny Women Championships for Ireland. And I did my 8 minutes talking about the wooden spoon and, you know, the usual stuff we all dealt with when we were kids. And she came up and she said, you're great. She said, I'm putting on a women's only comedy show with Joanne McNally at Electric Picnic.
Joanne McNally, who's really successful.
And Joanne is fantastic.
Amazing.
And she comes out to Portmarnock for a few times. She's brilliant. She'd be now the person I'd most aspire to be like if I were to stick with comedy. But so I was invited to do this, and so I did perform at Electric Picnic last September.
In front of how many people?
It was the Hazelwood, so it wouldn't have been your gigantic crowds. Yeah. It was probably a couple of thousand, I'd say.
But to me, stand-up comedy must be the most terrifying thing to do. From the outside, you're totally exposed. You're trying to get a reaction from people. Competitive sport is a safe environment compared to that, I think. How did you have the courage to do it?
I think the first night I did it at Whelan's, I was sick to my stomach. It was absolutely nerve-wracking. But I think when you get that first laugh, you sort of relax and you take a deep breath, and then you kind of just keep, you flow, you know. So I think I was very lucky, I suppose, that I never really got any boos. Maybe they felt sorry for me. And I think telling the truth also helps. Like, everything I talk about is true. And you know, Irish people, we tend to laugh at ourselves and we, you know, self-deprecating a lot.
Yeah, that's natural for us.
And it worked. And I have to say, it gave me an incredible confidence.
Did it?
Something that I never really had.
Interesting.
And you sort of, I found myself kind of being, like when I'm in a squash match, for example, if I'm losing or I'm down a few points, I'll say to myself, this is my stage. I've got the mic. You know, or something like that, that'll kind of get me back into the zone.
So there's a link.
Isn't that funny?
That's fascinating.
You just made me think about that now.
That's fascinating. Yeah. There's actually a link for you in that performance element of doing that.
Yeah, and that's maybe why I wear the jacket. Yeah. Maybe I'm a born performer. I don't know.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So
I don't do it anymore.
I was just going to say, did you keep it up? You did Electric Picnic. What a buzz.
It was incredible. Absolutely. I mean, definitely a highlight of my life. You know, bucket list.
Yeah, definitely. You
know, absolutely.
I don't think I've ever would have had it on my bucket list, but there you go.
I don't think I did either. But what I will say is I still host a show in Portmarnock once a month where I'll bring in comedians, and Joanne has been out twice and headlined for us, and so I'll MC a little bit.
Right.
But because my squash really has taken off so much now, that's my real priority is to really
Is it called anything in particular?
It's just Orla's Laughter Lounge.
Right.
You don't need to know about it.
My goodness.
You want to come to Portmarnock?
What a life you've led, Orla. I feel so boring.
I feel so underactive
having met you. Yeah. And how is your health now, would you say?
I'd say my health is probably at its best, knock on wood. I am fitter than I've ever been. I'm happier than I've ever been. And I think it all has to do with the
squash. Helped by your lovely wife, I presume, as well.
She's fantastic, yeah. She's a lunatic.
We haven't given her a name.
Debbie. Sorry, right. Debbie. She's in America at the moment, clearing out one of the old houses that we had. So we're definitely staying in Ireland now, which is great. When we first moved back 3 years ago, we weren't sure. But we're both sort of thriving in our sports.
Yeah.
She teaches pickleball, which it's a whole other...
What is pickleball?
So pickleball is, so I would say, in a nutshell, it's giant table tennis.
Right.
It's played on a badminton court. Four people, is a low net to the ground about this high. And the bat is sort of plastic solid.
And what kind of a ball?
It's a very... about this size plastic with holes in it.
Oh, like an air ball.
Yeah. And it's probably the fastest growing sport in North America.
Go away.
And
pickleball.
Pickleball. It's great.
There's a new one for your listeners. We never even heard of it before.
It's fantastic. The Irish Open is actually the end of the month in Multifarnham. And then we're having a tournament in Malahide Castle in July.
For
people coming from Germany. We played in the Spanish Pickleball Championships last year.
That's incredible.
A whole other thing, but it's great sport. Really, really fun. Yeah.
One of the things I was curious about as well was, has there been a little bit of a renaissance in Irish squash? Because I remember, like, I'm a child of the 70s, and squash was huge in Ireland, and there were private clubs like gyms all around the country.
Yeah.
And then a lot of them seemed to close down. And as I said, Madeleine Perry, I knew, was sort of the flag bearer for Irish squash for a long time and played professionally. But is the game, do you think the game is having a resurgence?
I do. And it's just, there aren't enough voices out there to sort of share. It's thriving. I had a great conversation with Paul Nugent, who's the CEO of Irish Squash, a couple of days ago. And he was filling me in stuff I didn't even know. There are clubs all around the country. There's one I have to just have a quick look at my notes.
I see Celtic squash because I go into Waterford and I often pass it. And I can see that's a professional, there's a club there that works.
Yeah,
like it's
so they actually got a sports capital grant last year, and they have two glass back courts there. So it kind of went from being dormant to now thriving with over 100 players. There's a place in Wexford called Barnstown. They actually just bought two glass back walls from a club in England that closed down, believe it or not. They're bringing them back, and they're going to... And that place apparently is thriving in Barnstown.
I believe there's one in Ballyshannon as well
named Ivan. So one of the things that we were saying, you know, the difference between squash in America and Ireland is, in Ireland it's very much volunteer-based, right?
Of course,
America, everybody is paid to do it. They probably employ 100 people and they're in US squash, whereas we have poor old Paul by himself.
Yeah.
You know, so it's very much, you need sort of champions of the game, ambassadors of the game. I'm not saying I'm one of them, but I kind of am. I came home, went to Portmarnock, and there was nothing happening. And now I have 75 kids playing. We have a community of about 50 adults playing. And so because I have the time and the passion, and this chap, Ivan O'Malley, I think his name is, up in Ballyshannon, he's done the same thing in Donegal.
Wow.
He's sort of, you know, he's brought the passion. And it's sort of
100 members, apparently. Yeah.
It's kind of sprinkling. I mean, De La Salle College is now in Waterford, introduced squash as a PE.
Yeah, because I'm presuming they can go up to Celtic. Teachers can take them up. There's a place for them to play.
Yeah,
but there seem to be courts popping up around the place. And
obviously, that were there and they're just being reinvigorated.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, to the sum of, I think, 250,000 was given in grants last year to clubs
capital
around the country.
Right.
And it's, you know, junior squash is thriving as well. I'll just briefly tell you about Sutton Lawn Tennis Club, which is where I happen to play league. Owen Ryan has done an incredible job. They have five courts there now at the moment.
Five courts?
Yeah, and he has probably, I'd say, and I'm hoping I'm getting this right, over 250 kids play every single day. That club is packed. And I mentioned Sam Buckley, who's in the semi-finals of the Europeans, plays there. And there are three players who are in Prague at the moment from Sutton that are playing. I'd say 70% of all the juniors, of all the Irish representative kids, are from Sutton, if that
right.
makes sense.
Yeah, like it's, yeah, it's obviously a growth.
It's booming. Three of the lads who are picked to go to the Europeans with our team are from Sutton. First timers, same as myself. And it's just, I mean, junior squash, you've got your interprovincials. So about 3 weeks ago, I think they had the junior interpro. So four provinces came together from ages 11 up to 19. Every province submits a team of five players. I mean, it's definitely, it's out there and it's happening and it's booming.
We're just not seeing it.
Kids are loving it. And I'm telling you, it's a great opportunity to get a scholarship to go to America.
Yeah.
There are kids, Brianne, who's on my team, went
What's
to George
name?
Washington, Brianne Flynn.
Right.
She's the Irish number two. She got a scholarship to go to George Washington. She was there for 4 years. And also Oisín Logan, who was in the same college with her. David Ryan, whose Owen Ryan's son, was in Harvard for 4 years and ended up winning the national championships. He was
in America.
Number one, unseeded.
Wow.
Or I think he was
and who's
eight.
The Irish number one woman?
It's Sophie O'Rourke. So Sophie, I think, I want to say she's going to be 19, if not currently. No, she's going to the European teams this week, so she must be almost 19. So
right.
you can't be 19 and play.
So she's still that young.
But she's from Cork.
Right. Oh, it's Cork, right.
Yeah, she's a fantastic little player. Feisty. She's amazing. So if you ever get a chance to watch her play, she's unbelievable.
Right. And your plan now is to, first of all, play Europeans?
Yes.
In when again do we say there are?
They are starting the 1st of May, so we've got squad weekends coming up the next two weekends where
and
all the teams
where
will
are
be
the
together.
Europeans?
They're in Birmingham.
Right, okay.
In Edgbaston Priory.
Okay, and that's the start of May?
1st of May to the 5th.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then your World Masters Championships, which you want to go
that's
to?
That's going to be another year from August. So between now and then, what I need to do, I sort of have to establish a ranking. I'm currently 15 in Europe. I went in at 60, I think, and because I've won Slovenia and Spain, your ranking goes up.
Is this but in your age group?
My age, yeah. So I need to get probably three or four more tournaments under my belt and obviously do well in them to kind of get, because when I go to Worlds, it's always better if you have a top ranking, a top seeding.
I presume then it's going to help you in your draw.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so you want to get your ranking up.
Yeah.
And then where are those Worlds? And
they're
in
Poland.
2020
August.
Right.
They're in Poland, and apparently the facility is unbelievable. They have 32 squash courts. It's in a giant warehouse.
Wow.
And people from all over the world now, there are some incredible, like Sarah Fitzgerald, who I mentioned earlier, I trained with her in Caversham. She was 5-time world champion. Now she'll come over and play in the over 50s.
Right.
And so I think anybody who enters the over 50s is probably...
It's going to be pretty competitive.
Yeah.
And did you play with the world number one recently somewhere?
I did. And I told her yesterday I'd give her a shout out.
Where's she from?
Reneem El-Walili. She's from Egypt.
Right.
And she was yesterday, the day before, she won the DBT Open in the Netherlands. And I sent her a little text to congratulate her yesterday, and she wrote back and she said, Orla, it's because I had that lucky penny you gave me. So when I played her in Birmingham a couple of weeks back... I always went, wherever I go, I'll bring something from Ireland to give to my opponents. Just a nice touch. So
you gave her the lucky penny.
Yeah.
So how did you get to play the world number one? This is the question I ask.
Kind of a selfish thing, but also I was wanting to support my friend Dion Safri, is launching a program called Empower Girl Squash in Birmingham. And it's a very similar program to the ones that Debbie and I ran in the States.
America.
So it's for low-income girls, predominantly. She gets them playing squash, she helps them with their academics, and then she provides a nutritious meal. So she is the first one in England, I think. No, there might be another one. Anyway, she is launching this program. And when I saw on Facebook that her launch included having four of the top 10 players in the world, including Reneem El-Walili, Sarah Jane Perry, who's world number 6, Tesney Evans, world number 9, and then Nicole David, who at the moment is world number 10, but literally is the greatest player of all time. She's 10-time world
Where
champion.
Where is she from?
She's from Malaysia.
Right.
She would be now your GOAT, we call her, the greatest of all time. So those four people are just going to be 45-minute flight away. You know, and I want to support Dion, of course.
And you're on that flight. You're on that flight, Orla, straight away.
Yeah, so I got on court with both Sarah Jane and Raneem, and just had the absolute best time.
Just to have a knock up, like. Basically.
Yeah, so they were. It was a fundraiser for the program. So you would pay to play with the pro. You know, it was £20 or something. It was easy.
So, fantastic.
Well, the funny thing was they didn't really know who I was. So when I got on with Raneem with this I was wearing the gold jacket. Of course I was. We had a very, very long rally for about a minute, which in squash terms is quite long.
Yeah.
And I ended up subsequently just winning the first rally. And was it. I said, that's it. But, you know, I have to say, for professional squash players, the four girls who were there, they're so approachable and friendly and easy to get on, and we're happy to talk to anybody. They're just,
You're not dealing with agents or anything.
Just amazing. I mean, you know, Raneem gave me her phone number. She said, I'm going to follow you because she knows I'm competing in the Worlds. And when I'm at the British Masters at the end of May, they're also having the professional British Open at the same time in the same venue. And, you know, everybody just
looks in together.
It's fantastic. It's really a great experience.
Well, it's a sport that has always, as I said, I remember being really big in the 70s, and also because everyone said, if you want a sport that is incredibly good for your for endurance fitness and for cardiovascular, that for a start, it's a great sport to play.
It's great, and you're not running after a ball that goes over a net. It's there, and you just pick it up, grab, and you go again. And it's a fun. I mean, 35 to 45 minutes of a workout, and
you're
happy.
And something that really interested me, and I think it was part of what caught my eye about you first as well, is you found your success, and you're finding your joy in your sport that you were really good at when you were young, much later in life. And does it make you reflect on why do women give up sport so early, or we know there's a high dropout sport very often because people have families and have children.
And
what's your advice to women about competitive sport and the opportunity to go back into competitive sport?
I mean, I think number one, I don't have children, and that has been sort of a, I don't want to say lucky thing for me, but it definitely, I think women who go off and have families, definitely their priorities change, and it takes away from their time and availability to commit to something.
Of course, we know
this. But I think if, you know, you should always make time for yourself, and if you can, whatever sport it is, it's that, like I said, it's a little bit of joy that'll bring to, it just, I don't know, it's for me, it's changed the way I look at things. I'm happier. Because I'm 48, doesn't matter. You know what? It's. I'm kind of stalling here now.
No,
to cut that out.
It's to come back to that one and say, for you, it's not a factor. Your age isn't a factor. Clearly, you're in great physical shape.
Yeah, and that definitely helps. I don't spend as much time on the squash court as I do. I spend more time in the gym because there's a lot of twisting and turning and squash, and the hips and the knees go. One of the things I talked with about just this other lady, Rosie Barry, I told you about earlier, she was an Irish lady who was voted in as vice president of the European Squash Federation, and one of her main responsibilities is master squash. So just getting back to the, you know, the over 35s, she really wants to sort of help get more women back playing.
Yeah.
And within Ireland, we sort of have this plan with my help to do some sort of regular coaching, where we'll get anybody who, maybe they played for Ireland as juniors, and I have so many friends who did, and then they put their rackets down in their early 20s, and an opportunity to just come back and, you know, don't expect to be as good as you used to be.
No.
But it's getting out there and getting the sweat going, and you remember how good it feels, and
there's,
you know,
nothing,
you're with your friends.
I think in a racket sport, there's nothing like that time when you hit, when you make a perfect contact with whether it's a shuttlecock or a ball.
It's
a beautiful feeling, isn't it?
It is. And it's also the camaraderie of, you know, I've connected with people who I hadn't seen in over 20 or 30 years now, because especially in this past Masters Interprovincials weekend, there were people who played as juniors and now they're back playing. And it's just, it's fun. And you can see, you know, their kids have grown up and now they're coming back to it. And it's time. Like, when your kids grow up, definitely make the time. Don't say, that's it now, I'll just go walk the dog on the beach, which is equally very important.
I think maybe it's a lack of confidence. You know, women's bodies change dramatically when they have children. Yeah. They also can go into gyms and be intimidated by a lot of younger people around them, and a sort of very macho environment sometimes, I think. Yeah. So I think there's an element there. We know women lack confidence, you know, about a lot of things.
That's a huge part of it. It really is. And it was definitely part of it for me. And a lot of it was self-belief. And I will say that I've kind of been working on my own sort of mental side of things. Reading a really good book at the moment by DC Gonzalez called I can't remember the name of it now. It'll come to me.
It'll come to you.
But it's about mental sort of strength. And what it's showed me is self-belief and confidence is a huge part of performing.
Yeah.
And I think, like you said, a lot of women, I'm sure I'm going through perimenopause, you know, the night sweats and the whole nine yards, and we're all going to go through it. But sport is going to help with that as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's, you take the attitude of, do I decide that I'm not going to do it, or decide I'm going to do it? And, you know, even if you get out there two or three times a week, whatever your sport is, you're going to feel good.
And we'll finish off by you telling us about you have older women come to your classes.
Yeah. It's interesting now that I've sort of, I'm dabbling now in personal training. Well, I shouldn't say dabble because it's my living. And the majority of my clients are probably women over 50, over 60, some of them. And it may be partly because I'm a friendly face, but, you know, we talked earlier about gyms where you've got the big guys who go in and they drop the weights and they're, you know, looking at themselves in the mirror. And I think women who are in their 50s and 60s want an environment where it's safe and it's friendly and it's comfortable and non-threatening. And I think I can help with that. And I'm hoping, just by being out there and doing the squash thing and doing the personal training, that I could sort of encourage women to just...
Well, I think there's probably lots of people like you. They may not have jumped back in at the level that you've jumped back in, Orla, but certainly I think there are a lot of women who, you know, love their sport, may have gone away from it, just might not be sure about whether they should go back in.
If you're
looking for a role model, here is one who absolutely, you've got everything. You know, you have the joy. We can see the joy. We can see the life. We can see the elite level. We can see the competitiveness.
Yeah.
But it's all there, and it's all come back to life for you.
And it's not all about winning. I want to say, it's like when I, you know, in Spain and Slovenia, there's beginners playing in the age groups that I'm in.
It's
having a good time and enjoying it. And that's why I'm doing so well, is because I'm enjoying it. So it doesn't, you know, don't worry about the, oh, I won't be good enough, wouldn't be good enough. Doesn't matter.
Right.
Get out there and play.
Well, look, as long may you enjoy it, long may you thrive and get better, and long may you bring colour to the courts, to the squash courts of the world.
It's been lovely talking to you.
It's been fantastic.
I love the hair, the colour. Like, we need to get a photograph.
We need to get a photo together. It's been great to have you in, and we hope, listeners, that will inspire people. If you've been out of sport, or, you know, you've lacked confidence in sport and have given up or are afraid to go back at any level, Orla Doherty is a brilliant example how it's changed your life, I think.
Yeah.
So,
brilliant.
For future reference, you can find, as I said, all our previous episodes on iTunes or on the offtheball.com. Go into their podcast links and you'll find all our off the benches in there. And we hope you enjoyed our latest one. Thanks for listening.